Welcome back. I hope, however, the time went was in some level nurturing and allowed us all a chance to kind of settle again into the body. As I said, we'll just move right into the sit. So I'm going to invite each of us to allow the body to come into a posture that allows us to feel upright and alert. And this might doesn't have to be sitting, actually. If the body is going to be best served by lying down, that's fine. It's more the energetics of alertness, of availability. So really just letting the body come into a posture that feels comfortable enough. Connecting in with the earth energies beneath and around us and the energies of the heavens that are above us, almost like plugging in both. Feeling into your place in the circle. Beautiful women. Whether it's your first time here, if you've here since the beginning in the days of Deborah and Julie. Yeah, just letting yourself take your place. And for the anchor of our sit today, have us first kind of come back to grounding, landing in the body. So again, if it's helpful to drop the attention into the lower half of the body and the sit bones, what you're resting upon, what's supporting you, the feet on the ground. Sometimes I like to press a little bit in the balls of my feet, just a way of here, connecting with the earth. And letting some of this attention in the body to stay here. So that there's an awareness of being in the body. And then allowing the other part of the attention just to watch the mind as we've done so many times before, but this with a sort of gentle curiosity of how is it in the mind, noticing the patterns where the mind goes, if it goes to the pattern of planning or judging or comparing, and that oft-given image of the mind, like the blue sky and the clouds. Come and go, and sometimes it seems like the clouds stay forever. Sometimes they just pass through. But can we be curious again, sort of with the patterns, the cloud formations? Does the mind tend to go to think about a particular person or a situation? Is the mind making lists? Is it moving into fantasy realm of things you'd like to be doing or planning? And really just allowing that observing part, the awareness, just to notice, oh, when left to its own devices, because we're not trying to corral the mind or have it do anything in particular, we're just letting this awareness notice with a gentle curiosity of, huh, the mind on this day, in this moment, tends to move in this direction. Again, planning, judging, comparing, wondering, like, what is this? I know, which could be doubt. Or if we look at through the lens of the hindrances, there can be a craving for something, an aversion, a pushing away of something. The mind can get dull, quiet, or dull, kind of like sloth, torpor in the mind. Or there's the restlessness, an agitation in the mind. Again, the sense of doubt of like, what is this? So those are the hindrances, right? They can have their own particular formation, the cloud formations, or almost like taints, like how a worry or a grasping might change the color of a particular cloud. I'd be getting a little out there in the metaphors, but just allowing there to be just a open, gentle curiosity of, oh, this is what's happening in the mind. Without the need for it to be otherwise, without needing to control it, just resting in the body and then resting in the awareness of, oh, in the mind just now, it's like this. Thinking, planning, judging, doubting, craving, aversive, and so forth. So please remember, there's no such thing as a bad sit. We come, we take our seats, we see how it is. to be alive in this very moment and then in the next. And if possible, and to keep leaning back into the support of the Sangha as we sit together. So, thank you. So lovely, as always, to sit together. And today I want to pick up, as we've been doing, this sort of march through the paramis, the perfections of the heart, much of which these last weeks have been based on the book by Ajahn Sucitto's book, The Paramis, Crossing Life's Floods. And today it's the parami of truthfulness. And the way he speaks about it, there are sort of two, and those of you who are new to the class, let me back up by saying the perfections of the heart, in some ways in the Buddhist mythology, the story goes that before the Buddha incarnated into Siddhartha, his that lifetime, the many lives before, he had embodied these different qualities of the heart, such as generosity, integrity, energy, wiseness of energy, wisdom, resolve, patience, and today truthfulness, as sort of he worked, he inhabited these perfections sort of as getting ready for his life as the Buddha in his enlightenment. So these qualities of the heart that are interwoven and not at all linear, but they do build upon each other, sort of the establishment of generosity and integrity, which are foundational to the practice overall, and then moving more onward into how we relate to the use of our energy and wisdom, patience last week, and then today, truthfulness. And truthfulness in this, in the parami, is sort of both the truthfulness of our speech. The teachings in the Eightfold Path of why speech, it's better not to lie. And that, and to that point, there's an article that came out 2012. It said, I forget where it's from, but there are two things you can say for sure about human beings. Our opposable thumbs make us great at using tools, and we are all big fat liars. By the age of 4, 90% of children have grasped the concept of lying, and it just gets worse from there. According to a 2002 study conducted by the University of Massachusetts, 60% of adults cannot have a 10-minute conversation without lying at least once. But even that number makes it sound better than it really is, because those people in the study who did lie actually told an average of 3 lies during their brief chat. And I know you're sitting there thinking, well, I would be part of the 40% that didn't lie. And that's what all the liars in the study thought too. When they watched the tape conversations back, they were shocked at how many lies they told. We lie to everyone. Our parents get the worst of it. 80%, 86% of us lie to them regularly, followed by friends, 75%, siblings, 73%, and spouses, 68%. But in general, we lie about things that aren't important, little things that make us think we will look better or be more likable. So with that in mind, that we all tend to be big fat liars, there's sort of opportunities for growth and awareness of where and why. And by lying, and in the teachings of wise speech, it's sort of where are we stretching the truth a little bit? Where are omissions? Where lying in its most broad sense of not 100% truthful? So the exaggerations would count, and it can be, and I use this word intentionally, just a fun way to play of where do I get sloppy or careless with my speech? Coming back to the first second of the paramis of integrity, it's sort of aligning ourselves with a sense of integrity. And in so doing, it as sort of serves as one of those things, the bumpers in the bowling lane that kind of keep us from actually lying because of our deep commitment to abiding in a sense of integrity. So just something to watch, sort of patterns of our speech in conversation with others. And I love that pointing to when are we trying to look a certain way or sound funnier than maybe we are, tell stories and embellishing, whatever. And again, holding it lightly and an awareness of oftentimes we do lie, but okay, let's pay attention to where. And it always sort of again in the mythology, it said that in all the many lifetimes of Buddha, he never told a lie. And I always found that somewhat depressing. Like that's a like really? And so if there's that aspirational, whether that's truth, but I have always sort of liked this idea of just looking at where and why. What's the intention beneath when we stretch the truth or we exaggerate or omit? And then that feels like it's a much more useful guide to be curious of, okay, where do I step out of a sense of integrity in my speech with others? And perhaps more importantly, with our own selves, sort of the lies we tell ourselves. Or the stories that we have taken hold, that may no longer resonate as true, either from our youth or from just different relationships, sort of that we've adopted certain stories people have about us, like Byron Katie's beautiful invitations about the narratives we tell ourselves. Is it true? Is it really true? How do we know it's true? And then what if it wasn't true? In this way of really being able to bring that sort of Manjushura, the deity of clarity and wisdom, to cut through that which is false, that which is sort of delusional. And I use that in the Buddhist sense of not seeing clearly, such that we can move from a deeper place of clear seeing, which in large part is what the teachings of this particular parami are about. So, and for me, it has a very close relationship with wisdom. Yeah, that sense of being able to see clearly into the nature of things. Impermanence. All things change. All that arises will pass away. That there is a abiding in that truth allows us to loosen the grip. And Suchito talks about this, that the mind might know that, like, yeah, we hear that all the time. Impermanence, whatever. But there's a way the senses or a different part of the mind can lock in, like, yeah, but this will last, whether it's a relationship or something that's delightful. The mind kind of wants to hold on, like, I got it. This is good. And that it can be an embodied sense. And that reliance there, that's sort of a delusional piece because it's like, oh, sweetie, you're going to lose it. Like, all that we come in contact with, we will lose. All that we hold dear, we will be separated from. It's a given. In this lifetime, it doesn't mean we've done anything wrong. There aren't ways to prevent it. These are just built-in conditions of this human life. In this book, in the Parmes, and it is available as an ebook. It's a little trickier to find as a book, as a non-ebook analog book, is that what we call them? Yeah, so it's the truthfulness as an aspect of morality. So that's an intentional piece, and then refers to perception, the ability to see or know things in an undistorted way. And we're really good, I'll speak for myself, at a habit, or when we're not paying attention, of seeing things as we want them to be or as we think them to be. Yeah. So they're distorted, which is also under that idea of deluded thinking. And this beautiful invitation to, like, okay, how can we cut the sword of Manjushara coming through to cut through it? But also, it can be helpful as we look at the hindrances, which are also those valences of the grasping, the pushing away, the sleepiness, dullness of the mind, the agitation of the mind, restlessness, and then doubt, that those can be almost like valences of being able to see things truly. Truthfulness as behavior, and truthfulness as understanding and realization are related, and so are dishonesty and confusion. We find ourselves being dishonest or exaggerating or being economical with the truth because it's more convenient, or we want a result to be in our favor. But then again, we're not always aware. So this, the deeper invitation, much like in the instructions, was like, can we be aware of the patterns of the mind? And by naming, for me, my mind, left unbidden, can incline towards worrying and its flip side, planning. And just being able to note, oh, worry, planning, allows there to be some distance. Oh, okay, that's what this mind pattern is. And in that distance, there can be an exhale, and then the choice points come in. They're like, do I want to keep worrying about this or planning that? No, not necessarily. But in that space, there can be a choice. And in that space is also an ability to see things more clearly or less bound up in it. So he talks about, again, sort of what clouds the truthfulness, what gets in our way, what obscures the clarity is the assumptions we have, the assumption that things might last forever, or there's a preference that things might last. And that he talks about how the assumptions and impulses are biologically or socially conditioned. We don't decide to have them. And yet the voice in the brain or the surge in the heart is so familiar and habitual that it may seem very real to me. He talks about, as a monastic, sort of dealing with the sexual feelings. And when they come up, and it's the shame that can come in, like, ah, I'm a monastic, I shouldn't have that. And his sort of settling into, there's a biological wiring such that these feelings will come up. Oh, okay. So then allowing them to pass through without all that judgment of the storytelling of how we should or shouldn't feel that way. And for many of us, anger can fit in that category of Sometimes, like, I'm a spiritual person, I shouldn't get angry. I shouldn't be angry. Or we've had bad experiences with other people's anger, perhaps when we were young or as we've gotten older, that it's like, I don't want to be an angry person. We're somehow pushing it away. We exile these parts of ourselves. And being able to kind of sit back and like, no, anger's going to come. And being able to touch into it, to acknowledge, yes, this is present, but not be so bound up in it that it becomes true or the only thing we do see. So being able to see kind of the multidimensional experience of our own emotional relational life, like, oh, we can with practice make space for anger comes up. Okay, it can be unpleasant, it can be empowering, it can be many things, and it can also move through. He talks about in terms of behavior, our actions. So he links it with karma. In the search of spiritual truth, at the heart of such a quest is the need to acknowledge and put aside false assumptions. Assumptions that are generated by the floods of sensuality, becoming views and ignorance. And it means paying attention in an appropriate, inquiring, in-depth way. This is the intention based on truthfulness, not to have a particular experience or become something, but to step out of the thinking of assumptions into that place of clarity. So when we kind of can abide in a place of awareness, oh, I'm watching my mind do this or that, there's truth in that. There's a resting in being able to observe because we're not bound up in it. A basic assumption is that things have a fixed or predictable nature. So I'm talking about, even though we rationally know it isn't true, our emotional reflexes get confused and upset by changes in weather, changes in our health, delays in sitting in traffic, changes in other people. And this reflex assumption is a sense that objects provide a true and lasting feeling. But that's what we kind of want it to be, and it doesn't work out that way. And then we fight against it. So when we can watch that, bring in that kind of sort of clarity again, be like, oh, that doesn't actually work. It doesn't work that way. Coming back into it's again that awareness, and then watching where the intentions arise, where the mind is going. So in other words, the intention or the bent or inclination of the mind has changed how we experience whatever it is, food, engagement with ourselves, with another person. If we're in a good mood, oh my God, this is the best meal ever. If we're in a crappy mood, like, I hate this, right? So our mood colors what's true. When we can have the awareness of, oh my gosh, I'm in a really bad mood, it can help provide this distance because there's some observing part that's online to be like, oh, because there's a negative bent, okay, then this, I don't like the way this is. It's colored by that mood. And that it's both subtle but extremely powerful to have that awareness of, oh, this is, these conditions are this way because my perception or my experience is, I'm really tired, I haven't eaten, and I'm really grouchy. Okay. So if we can tend to the truth of, if I could eat a little something and tend to the body in a way, then there can be a greater ease in knowing what's true of what we can change. So not being so bought into the idea of when we're in a bad mood that that's true. Like, no, I don't like this in this particular day, and it's always going to be that way. It's like, oh, sweetie, this just might be the context. So that might be a better way to look at it, of being able to understand conditions and causes will impact how we view things. And this invitation around the parami of truthfulness is, let's look at what the conditions and causes are, and to be able to determine then what is actually true. With when he talks about karma, the mental activity is how your mind acts and assumes and projects. And in so doing, you create an inheritance. We end up stuck in a world of them and us with fixed opinions, disappointments, and confusion. Karma means action. It's based on intention, attention, and contact. It's results with this when it's running your life. So if you're not actually paying attention to what am I intending to do? Where is my intention going? And how am I behaving with it? When we're in kind of that mode of automatic and not paying attention, again, we're very susceptible to that more diluted thinking. So to be able to stop, okay, what's actually true in this moment? So in the arriving sit, it's like checking out, how is the body actually? How is the mind? What's going on in the mind? What's the patterning of the mind actually in this moment? How is the heart? Leans us back into a place of awareness such that we're better able to kind of suss out what's actually true. And the mind is can be shameless in sort of the telling its own lies. And one of the, I think it's Ajahn Pasno, has a talk on YouTube, and it's just like, I think it might just be called "The Mind is a Liar" or something like that. And he sort of talks about learning, turning towards the mind and be like, you know, there's all these lies happening, which I think was just so kind of hilarious, but also poignant in how do we start to look at the stories we tell ourselves that are not necessarily true about other people, about ourselves, about the world. And again, by slowing down and resting in that place of, okay, can I be in this body? Can I rest in the sense doors of listening to sound, present moment, taste, present moment, touch, present moment? There's that awareness, right? Dropping into this space of awareness, feeling that in the body, if there's a sense of calm, congruence, this can help establish the ground by which we can determine what's true. So if I'm running a story of fear, which is easy to do these days, my body's going to feel different. Like it tends to kind of be up and tighter. And being able to discern from a felt sense is so helpful in terms of being able to guide us to when we're in a place of fear, anxiety, aversion, resentment, all of those kind of clusters of emotions, versus the more open-hearted sense of generosity, truthfulness, patience, these places of the paramis. So it's really important. We'll do this, get to this in a minute, of being able to have a felt sense of when we are able to abide in a place of awareness, because that allows us to understand sort of a ground of our own truth. It's undistorted in a way. Yeah, he talks about the ground of truth in daily life. When there's been an upheaval of opinions and rumors and blame, we benefit from having some solid ground. The development of the ground of truth is in three ways. First, there's morality, which I spoke of before. Kind of, I would use synonymously the word of integrity, of are we relating to ourselves in a truthful way? Am I running a narrative that is actually congruent with what I know to be true? If I'm standing on my own ground of truth, am I running a story about somebody else or the world around me that is based on more of the kind of diluted, grasping, pushing away type of thinking when we're caught in hindrances? So being able, again, to come back to a sense of integrity, can I speak from a truthful place in a place of coherence? That would be the morality component of the ground of truth. The next is awareness. Truthfulness provides stable ground with regard to the quality of awareness. This has to do with clearing the mind of greed, hatred, and delusion, the hindrances that I've been speaking of. Important aspects of this training are mindfulness and concentration. Mindfulness gives us the ability to keep a frame of reference, staying with what we value, what's important to us, and not get pulled off into any number of sort of beliefs and the rigidity of thoughts that can pervade sort of social media and the news today, for sure. The third ground of this development of truth is the development of transcendent wisdom. When the mind is aware of its awareness, so when the mind, we're sitting in awareness of the mind, watching the mind, aware of its awareness, it's suspended from the floods that in, of greed, hatred, delusion, of becoming, of the way the personality can get involved. So kind of what he means by the floods. We begin to see things truthfully rather than thinking, oh, she's like this, he's like this, I'm like that. That's more the proliferation of the papancha mind, generative of thought. The stress, pressure, and suffering, this is the origin of so much of the deluded thinking. When one repeatedly undertakes this process of really examining and bringing a sense of awareness to how we're thinking, how we're speaking, how we're moving in the world, the honesty within it, an orientation towards cultivating honesty and candor, these proliferating tendencies of the mind tend to cease. The hallmark of truth is that one feels clear, open, and settled in actuality in what is true. There are no more grumbles, no more sighs or resignations or triumphs. The mind rests in awareness. Only in truthfulness will return the mind to the home of awareness from which it arises, and then we feel clear and balanced. So it's a beautiful both aspiration, like yes, how nice it would be to rest in the awareness, but these steps of really being able to check the mind is what I'm saying. Because I've spoken before, is this what I'm thinking leading me to stress, or is it to ease? We can also check, is this true? Is it really true? How do I know it's true? What if it wasn't true? Shifting gears a moment. Let's share. This is going to be a little bit longer talk today, so bear with me. From Gil Fronsdale's. Nope. Sorry. He has an article called the on his website, Mid Peninsula Insight, I think, Gil Fronsdale's Perfection of Truth. He talks about the variety of forces that come together to give truth its power, the force of inner purity and calm that can only be found in truth and honesty. Another aspect that both emboldens our sense of truthfulness and kind of can help us develop the quality of truthfulness as confidence comes with being able to understand and knowing and feeling in the body what is true. Another strength is of good intentions that stand behind speaking the truth. Still another is a way of making reconciliation and forgiveness possible when I can take responsibility of, like, wow, I said that thing and it was unkind, or it wasn't true, or it's kind of a jerk when I said it. Then there's a but honesty with myself of claiming, like, ugh, I stepped outside my own integrity when I was speaking from that place. But then it also allows me to own it with somebody else. I did this, I take responsibility for it. Then we become a softer, easier person to relate to because we can claim and honor what's true, both positive and negative about how we're responding, and understanding that's part of being human, right? We're going to say things like, ooh, I wish I wouldn't have said that. But being able to take responsibility and owning the truth of it, like, ow, what I said hurt you, and I'm really sorry. Buddhism also uses truth as a way to find release from the clinging and suffering that ensues. This is a little bit funny. In Gaber Mate, I think it's his book, The Hungry Ghost. It talks about the truth helps us known by what is felt, not so much about making sense of it intellectually, but how it feels in the body. So knowing truth in the sense of the heart and the gut and the mind. He writes, without the heart and gut knowledge, we often find that we function as genius level reptiles. So when we want to avoid operating as genius level reptiles, it's how to be able to have that check of congruence. Is what I'm feeling and know to be true? Does that resonate in the mind? Does it resonate in the heart and resonate in the gut? And again, we'll get to this in a moment. This poem by Bridget Anna McNeil, Remember. Remember who you are. Not the shape others have put on you, not the story they handed you, nor the lies or the needs that were pressed into your psyche. Not even your own imagined ideas of what you should be, but the real you, the wild innate you that is breathing under all those should-be's, all those untruths. Remember the feel of it, the shape of it. Let it inhabit you like golden weeds rewilding the concrete. And this from Ajahn Sumedho, awareness. Awareness is your refuge, awareness of the changingness of feelings, of attitudes, of moods, of material change and emotional change. Stay with that because it's a refuge that is indestructible. It's not something that changes, it's a refuge you can trust in. This refuge is not something that you create. It's not a creation, it's not an ideal. It's very practical and simple, but easily overlooked or not even noticed. When you're mindful, you begin to notice it's like this. So I'm going to invite you to close your eyes. Again, if it's helpful, kind of hand to the heart, hand to the belly, and breathing into the body, checking in. How is it in the body? It's like this. Again, part of that opening. Arriving, sit. It's like this in the body. It's like this in the mind. It's like this in the heart. This is our refuge. This is awareness. And just taking a moment just now to see if you can connect into that place of awareness. And as I mentioned before, another on-ramp in a way to the awareness can be just dropping into the sense of the sound of my voice, whatever smells may be present where you're sitting, sounds outside the room you're sitting, the temperature, the surface that you're sitting upon, the touch of it. You know, our senses are so wonderfully oriented in the present moment. And so allowing ourselves to drop into, in as much as possible, just now, this place of awareness, this refuge of awareness. And then I'm going to invite each of us just to call to mind some of those stories that we either others have handed to us, or that were pressed into our psyche, or even our own imagined ideas of who we should be, how we should be, what our lives should look like. And just to kind of watch if some of these thoughts or stories or narratives kind of float through your awareness. How I think my life should be, who I should be, what I should be doing, what I've been told I am. And notice if we pick one or two of these phrases, or maybe there are a couple sentences, how it lands in the body, if there's a constriction or a tightening in any way, a weight. A story we may have of ourselves from, again, from when we were young, that kind of intellectually, like, yeah, that's not true anymore, but it can still live on. Sense of there's something wrong, or we haven't done something right. And allowing there to be in a kind of an exploration or an opening up to how does that feel in the body? As we follow, like, is it true? Is it really true? How do you know it's true? What if it wasn't? What if we were to put that story down, that narrative of ourselves, that which has been pressed into our psyche or handed to us? We put that down. Allow us instead to step back into, or perhaps when we sat next to our heart earlier today, to sit beside this beautiful heart of ours and feel into the qualities that are innate, born in qualities of our heart. Love and kindness, joy, equanimity, compassion, truthfulness, patience, wisdom, generosity, humor, joy, a sense of lightness, play. Whatever qualities come to mind when you allow yourself to drop in what you know to be true about yourself. Setting aside doubt, setting aside aversion, but letting yourself claim these innate qualities of your own beautiful, evolving, wise heart. Spoken before, sort of this. Constellations of these paramis that can guide us through challenging times. They can also guide us back into a truthfulness of our own being. And how does that feel in the body? Allowing ourselves to accept the truth of these heart qualities. That are evolving, that we can practice with, that which resonate deeply with us, these qualities that we most want to deepen and engage with, they're already there, right? And we just clear away that which gets in the way, that which inhibits or hinders the expression. But just to take another moment here to really drop in with, oh yeah, these qualities are what resonate the most when I think of my own wise, open, beautiful heart. And even if there's some voice of doubt, okay, just doubt, but allowing there to be an opening into what's the truth feel like when I allow myself to inhabit these qualities? And what might it be like to move in the world, when this is the ground from which I move. Touching into this place of awareness, this refuge that is always available and can serve as a guide to when we can forget or feel disconnected from these heart qualities that are our birthright. So I am going to stop here and thank you for your kind attention.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.